The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What I was thinking about meditating with just now and also before this sit is something about the way that Sayadaw Utejaniya teaches, that's the primary teacher of Andre Fella, and how he teaches this perspective on insight meditation that is really informed by the third and fourth foundations of mindfulness, by attending to mind and attending to what's called mind objects, which is anything that happens in the heart and mind, an emotion, a thought, a perception, a belief, all that stuff. But there's also the way he teaches, and that is something that's a little bit harder to transmit. If you listen to his talks on Dharma Seed or have ever had the fortune of going to visit him at a retreat center or at his monastery, there's this lightness about him. He really holds things lightly. And there'll be these big group practice discussions, right? And people will be talking about seeing the things that one typically sees in the third foundation in the mind, greed, hatred, delusion. And by the end of the practice discussion, everybody will be laughing about having seen these things because it's good news, right? It's good news to see them because if we see them, they don't have us hooked by the nose and they're not dragging us around. We see them. We're a little bit free. The seeing free is just a touch. The awareness itself isn't tangled up in greed if I notice the greed in the same way it is if I don't. So I wanted to talk about these kinds of flavors of a wise attitude that are really supportive in being able to see the parts of our hearts and minds we might not like as much or from a Buddhist perspective are not wholesome. They're not helpful. So that lightness, that sense of humor is a huge asset to cultivate. One way that's been helpful for me in cultivating it is something I believe Andrea came up with this on a retreat. I haven't heard her talk about it in years, but maybe I invented it. It's a believability index. Okay. So this is a 1 to 10 chart or a 0 to 100 chart, depending on how numbers oriented you are, for how believable any given thought is when it pops into the mind. And it's just so helpful sometimes. It's like that thought can have so much authority when I actually subject it to, you know, how accurate is that likely? And it gets a 4 out of 10 or a 2. It's a way of catching the imagination in action, right? And it's okay to be a little playful with it. I heard Joseph Goldstein talk about this on a long IMS retreat once, and he'd actually invented this little cartoon character in his mind, was, been, will be, or something like that. And it was just a reminder to him, right? When things got really bad, that almost always the thoughts are something that used to happen, or that we've imagined might happen, or that we imagine will happen. And so just the playfulness. That doesn't exactly fit into receptive interest as a practice, but this is a skillful means that can be used when the mind gets a little unruly. I'm sure your mind never gets unruly, but mine does sometimes. So other flavors of the wise attitude that are helpful for this noticing of greed, hatred, and delusion are really their opposites. So like when you think about greed, what might you think the opposite would be? Like from my perspective, there could be a number of answers to that, but generosity is one. Contentment is another one. When I think about hatred, oh gosh, or aversion, let's do the whole range, right? Well, metta, loving kindness, compassion, even indifference are all quite far away from hatred, right? And then delusion, mindfulness, wisdom, discernment. So all of these are really helpful qualities to cultivate in order to be able to see generously, kindly, clearly, clarity, discernment, wisdom, the greed, hatred, and delusion operating even at the very subtlest levels of our minds. And then they're not a problem, because what we see, we can free. Especially if it's seen without an attitude of needing something to happen. Hating my hatred is going to make more hatred in the mind. Right? Doesn't help so much. What else to say about this? Yeah, here's something. All of the flavors of wise attitude that I've found that are consistently wise attitude have something in common besides the wise part. And that is that there's some kind of equanimity involved. So even if it's joy, there's some kind of equanimity. It's like appreciative joy that doesn't need to hang on to that thing and keep it. It's the kind of joy that has an open palm. Mindfulness that is open to what arises and what passes away, as opposed to the kind of mindfulness, and I think we've probably all done it, being very mindful of that thing so it will go away, right? Doesn't work so well, generally. At least, I don't think I found it ever worked for me. So it's the attitude that comes along with some of these that we're really looking for. So there's a flavor of equanimity. We don't have to, I'm not talking about necessarily the most high exalted equanimity you can get. That's beautiful. That's the crown jewel of Buddhist mind states. I'm just talking about your garden variety, daily life. I'm okay with it. Equanimity, you know, it's all right. That level is enough. You don't need to aspire to the highest heights necessarily. So all of these are not things to do in the meditation. They're things to notice and to appreciate in that open-handed way when they do arise, because they will allow for the clear seeing of the other factors of mind. Other qualities of mind. Is the mind tense or relaxed? Is it spacious or contracted? Is it feeling free or is it feeling caught? Is it wound up in something or is it calm and peaceful? It's not like these less pleasant states are wrong, but again, it's noticing them. It's okay. Being with, allowing, and stepping back. And it's in the stepping back. It's in the seeing the attitude of how we see these things. That's one place where freedom can lie. Just a little bit of freedom, little touch. So I hope that made sense. Be interested in any questions you have about it or any questions you have about your practice in general. That's what I've got to start us off with tonight. I'm going into Q&A mode now. Yes, Anthony and then Fred. I'm just going in the order I saw you. So. Anthony, I think you're still muted. Oh, here. Now I let you unmute. Sorry. There you go. Sorry to silence you.
Thank you. Yeah, Mike, I just wanted some your insight on the, so out of meditation, I got a fairly good pattern down of like connecting with the breath as the anchor. Mm-hmm. And calming that, you know, in that I calm my, I get a sense of calm. And then of course, when my mind starts to wander, I catch it and I bring it back to the anchor. Mm-hmm. But my question to you is, I have a hard time like knowing, like, so when I catch my mind wandering, I tend to see, try to stay in that. I'm having a hard time staying in that, whatever it was wandering on, and dropping that question in of what's going on here, you know, or what is, you know. So my question to you is, how do you, is that okay? Like to, so pretty much I'm catching myself. Once I notice that I'm caught in thought, you know, that I'm off in thought or whatnot, it sort of dissipates. It dissipates, and then I connect back to the breath. But as far as like inquiring about what I was thinking about, I'm having a hard time.
Okay, that makes total sense. Thoughts are very subtle creatures, right? Often, and they're shy, like you aim too much attention at them and it's very common for them to sort of go. So you don't need to make a project out of it. That's the first thing I'll say. Like what you're describing with your directed attention practice with your breath and then bringing your attention back to the breath, that is a totally valid form of practice. And there's nothing wrong with continuing to do that if that is what works for you. The invitation in this more open awareness style is at the moment you notice that you're lost, maybe the mind has such training with going back to the breath that that's what happens and that's fine. But just notice if there might be any lingering sense of maybe the mood of what was there, or maybe there's an image left over or something like that. You don't have to go hunt for it, but just allow, sometimes there's like a little lingering that happens that can just be sort of noticed receptively without having to try to be like, oh, what was that thought train there? Like you don't need to get into that stuff. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a skill like anything else to learn to allow the awareness to percolate through some of these other places. And the most natural way I found for it was when the mind sort of, if it snaps back to the breath, for example, if it's like really accustomed to being on the breath, to just sort of be interested, not even to try, but just be interested. It's like, oh, what was that? That's it. Nothing more. And if gradually you might end up seeing more, that's great. Okay.
Thank
let me
you.
Know if that, you're welcome, and let me know if that didn't answer it. We can try again. But
oh,
give it
did.
A shot.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
You're welcome. Fred Brannaman.
Hi. Thank you, Dawn. Yeah, I really like that believability scale. You know, I often will drop in this like, is it true when there's this some thought, especially if it's a ruminating sort of thing, but I can always kind of debate whether it's true or not. I can always kind of convince myself maybe it is, but I like the believability scale because most of them are not believable. And that's kind of a playful way to look at it. I really appreciate that. So thanks. And the way you put the everyday equanimity as like I mean, I don't know, just having some awareness that it's there, that it's present, that maybe it's something like contentment, maybe that there's just like nothing more needed, but that's such an against the stream kind of attitude to just like be okay with the moment as it is and not constantly needing to tweak it or adjust it. Or I feel like that's mostly my mental activity, is trying to make the moment better or less worse. So anyway, thank you. It was nice.
You're welcome. I can't remember who said this, but some famous teacher said basically most of mindfulness meditation, most of spiritual practice, is learning how not to make things worse. It's like that simple, right? Can we just get there? Can we get that far? And something about the believability scale. Oh yeah, this is from Pema Chodron, wrote this. And in the earliest years of my practice, I had it taped to my bathroom mirror. And it was three words: are you sure? That was it. And it was a really helpful practice. Just, oh, really? Any other thoughts? Yes, Ali.
Hi. I'm wondering if there is any value in wandering mind, not bringing it back and just letting it go.
So define what you mean, value in your meditation, value in general.
Yeah, because eventually it'll come back. Yeah, eventually it'll settle down. Maybe, you know, it needs to take a break. I don't know what the hell it does, but...
So it's a wonderful question. So from the standpoint of the receptive awareness practice,
mm-hmm, yeah.
If you can allow the mindfulness to go with the mind wandering, and I don't mean you have to necessarily keep track of every single thing it's thinking, but even just being aware, oh, mind is wandering, mind is kind of drifty. That is a beautiful way to start expanding the scope of what your mindfulness, sati, what it is aware of. And that can go very, very far. It is possible to stay mindfulness through the process of falling asleep and into dreaming, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that can even happen. So it's a lovely practice if you can do it. It takes, and I say do, it's almost more allowing it to happen. It takes practice in this form to cultivate that. The other value I've noticed is, and this is maybe the mindfulness isn't as sharp, but there's just enough to notice, oh, wandering mind. And like, especially that like drifty daydreamy mind where thoughts are a little weird and maybe like don't totally make sense. And at the quieter ends of the spectrum, they call it a hypnagogic state. It's sort of like this in between waking and sleeping state. I've heard some teachers kind of dismiss that. I don't dismiss that state. Like, that entire process to me is a beautiful marker of the mind and heart starting to relax. And that's actually part of the settling process for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. So to just notice it and appreciate it and like not try to fight against it is, there's a lot of value in that. Like, oh, drifty mind. Oh, very drifty mind, relaxing mind. And then Andrea talks about sometimes she'll notice her mind will just go off and it just clearly needs a break. It's like, okay, mind taking a break. That's fine. So there's definitely value in it. And I don't want to set the expectation up that it's always possible to do. Like, you know, I've been practicing for well over 15 years, and there are times where I'm still like, oh, just woke up in the middle of full-fledged daydream. Okay, here we are. So, you know, our minds come installed with that stuff, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Any other questions or comments? Anthony, please.
Yeah, just a quick thought that came to mind with your when you brought up about equanimity. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking of the emptiness, and what just came to my mind is that, you know, with, you know, being in everyday life, work and, you know, whatnot, that there is a balance there between, you know, the emptiness and then the ego, so to speak. Not the ego, but the self, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's kind of a balance there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important thing to note. Definitely. Can you say a little bit more about the balance, what it means for you?
So I think that, you know, to be in complete state of emptiness would kind of be kind of, it could be kind of out there, so to speak, in everyday life. So, you know, we do gotta, you know, connect with our characteristics, so to speak, in our work, in the workplace, with your, in your whatever setting it is. And so there is, I just thought of that word equanimity, and it came to mind with the balance, you know.
Beautiful. I appreciate what you're saying about balance. And I actually forgot to mention this as one of the flavors of wise attitude is simply balanced mind. Sort of a, it can feel very normal, very mundane, very, very normal. What you're saying about the balance between emptiness and, like, I would say a healthy ego structure, right? That's also really important. If not that you need to do it to practice, but if you were to read the ancient discourses, it's very clear that the Buddha had a healthy ego structure. He had not just dissolved into nothingness. He wandered around and taught for decades and ran a monastic order and got into debates and advised rulers and, you know, all these things, right? Fully awakened, the ego structure still was there. It was just the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's what he was empty of, right? He wasn't empty of being a human. And the point you're making is super valuable, right? We need our full capacities in our lives, right? Our capacity to connect with each other, our capacity to connect with ourselves, to be savvy, to show up. So, yeah, balance.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions, comments, ideas this conversation is sparking? So I'm just going to riff on balance for a few minutes. What Anthony brought into the room. So in the ancient suttas, mindfulness is almost like the fulcrum. If you think about a child's teeter-totter, mindfulness is the supporting piece in the middle, right? It is the balancing factor. So there can be energy and investigation on one end that really sort of build up the energy, and there can be calm and samadhi on the other end. And those, we're kind of always trying to bring those into balance in meditation. But you never have to worry about having too much mindfulness. Mindfulness itself, that balances out everything else. And I just use a simple example of five factors of mind, but this can go into seven factors of mind or all of the factors of mind. It's like the mindfulness itself helps us integrate. And then there's another quality. Mindfulness is sati, sampajanya, which is often translated as clear comprehension. But I like another translation even better, which is mindfulness of context or awareness of context. So how are we applying this practice in this situation? How is it appropriate? Is it appropriate? Like I was in Burma, one of the two times I was in Burma, I was learning something called the Mahasi style practice. And one of the signature things about that practice is you're learning to notice minutiae of experience. So they ask you to move very, very slowly. And you could always tell when a yogi had been at the meditation center a little too long because they would be moving very, very slowly, even if there was a car coming down the meditation center driveway, right? Like the mindfulness of context wasn't always there. It was too much about the minutiae of the details. So that's another form of balance is what am I applying my mindfulness to? This can be contextual like that, or it can be ethical. A classic example is in wrong mindfulness. That's the kind of mindfulness a thief might have in stealing through a house, getting ready to rob people. The thief is very aware of where they're placing their feet and how much noise they're making and where they are and where the other people in the house are. The intention is a little off, right? Whereas wise mindfulness is in the purpose of building the wholesome, right? The purpose of building benefit to yourself, benefit to other people. So balancing. Even the lightness, right? Yes.
I guess that's why they say at the end of the retreats, you know, longer retreats, just to be mindful when driving home, because you're going really slow, and then Ram Dass was saying like he's going like 45 miles an hour in the 60 mile hour freeway. You almost got a ticket of just going too slow.
This was you or someone else?
No, someone else. No.
Okay.
Because Ram Dass was explaining that.
Yeah, Ram Dass was explaining.
Yeah. I was just going, and then he had a big conversation with the. The guy, the police officer. Anyway, yeah, maybe that's what. But then I don't know if you have a minute for a couple of minutes. Should I ask you another question, Don? Or
yeah, I'll try to make a quick answer. Sure.
To what extent are you? Do you think, you know? I mean, like when we're in the conversation, I mean, we see someone, or in our heads, the emotion arises first, and every other thought that comes in is just the following of that emotion that's been set in early childhood, and the thoughts, you know, form from there, including many judgments.
So
I mean, I know it's like a big topic, but
it's a big topic, but I'll actually flag it for either next week or for Andrea.
That'd be great. Yeah. Thank you.
Because you're saying in conversation or when relating to other people, to what extent are the thoughts and judgments arising sort of based on imprints of emotion and beliefs
emotion
that are already there
versus.
Mm-hmm. So the one thing I will say about it is it's a two-way street, right? Our emotions definitely generate thoughts, and then the thoughts turn around and they will generate still more emotions. This is probably not news to you, but to be mindful of how that process works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in conversation, it's a different level of awareness. I find it really helpful to be grounded in the body and just notice when my emotions start to get activated. I can remember still to this day having a really intense conversation with my little sister after I'd gotten serious about meditation. And it was such a aha moment because I could feel all the emotions coursing through, but I didn't have to speak from them. It's like, oh, yeah. So thank you for the question. It's a big one. You could do a series on that easily.
Yeah.
So we have managed to make it through a full hour, folks. I just want to take a moment to dedicate the benefits of this practice. So trusting that the goodness that we've cultivated here together will ripple through each of our lives and outwards, rippling through the lives that we touch and the lives that they touch. May all beings be safe, happy, and peaceful. May all beings be free of suffering. Thank you so much for your kind attention, each of you.